speaking tonight out of two reasons, and I hope can generate a fair amount of discussion. About 10 years ago, out of my own background and interest, I was given a special grant to use a Lutheran seminary in St. Louis, before its demise, for a pilot study on the role and relationship between the arts and liberal arts, as well as the fine arts, and performing arts, and musical arts, and its role in the life of the church, and particularly in theological education. And I had the privilege of traveling throughout our country for about a year, and visiting and talking to many artists, and to seeing many faculty men at different seminaries, both Lutheran and non-Lutheran, and getting to visit various centers where the arts were being practiced and performed in San Francisco and in Los Angeles, at Claremont School of Theology and Film, the University of Chicago and Literature, Union Theological Seminary in both music and drama, and Indianapolis and St. Louis and various other cities throughout the country. And at that time, if you recall, right after 1965, when President Johnson had passed through Congress a bill which, for the first time in the history of our country, began to offer subsidies toward the arts. Most of you are familiar with the various state art commissions which came out of that initial and very important move on the part of our government to show as much interest in the humanities, if we would put it that way, at least in the arts, as they had shown in the sciences since the Sputnik scare, and to begin to at least to offer the resources of some of the budget. It's so minimal, it's unbelievable. But to offer these to performing artists and active artists in the country. Well, at that time also, the Carnegie Foundation had done a study, and it's all leading to one of the things I think is most fascinating, is that whether we realize it or not, for the first time in our culture, and it's, I think, peculiarly and especially realized here at Golden Village, for example, the people who perform and make things, the performing artists, and the people who consume them and interpret them have been brought together largely in universities and increasingly in communities in which there is a deep recognition of how the life of the artist and the insight of the artist and the work of the artist depends very much on the task of an intelligent citizenry. And I have to admit that for myself as a teacher, I find my primary function is to watch young people grow and develop and to see them exercise those skills in interpretation and judgment, which I think we find are extremely important for our citizenry. And so I thought it would be neat to sit down and share with you some ideas about the church and the arts, and possibly to enter the discussion, and maybe you'd be interested in some of the more recent directions that this has taken. And I see Holden Village as a kind of possible model for ways in which the arts and the community and the citizenship, particularly within the larger community of the Christian faith, can be given a special thrust and dimension. That's one of the reasons for wishing to address with you the question this evening, and the other is to offer a corrective. About a week and a half ago, I did give a talk on Christianity and the arts in this very room, and what I did is I took essentially a Lutheran approach. I used a famous letter of Martin Luther's, in which he writes to a man named poet, contemporary poet of his own time, Eobin Hess. He talks about why the arts, particularly poetry and rhetoric, and by that he meant all of the arts, are extremely important for the young people. And my essential argument that evening, an exposition, was an argument, an exposition along the lines that the arts are, after all, a very key, what we call propaedeutic. That is, they were what Luther called St. John the Baptist. They are the scabbards which hold the sheath of the Word of God, is the way he might put it. They prepare the people, he said, for the reception of the gospel. Now, that is not so naively Reformation or medieval, I think you'll recognize when you hear a man like Paul Tillich in a conversation with T.S. Eliot. And Paul Tillich in his Theology of Culture will say, and he gives a little record of a chance meeting he had with the poet T.S. Eliot. And in the meeting, the two start asking one another about their particular vocations. Tillich is a great systematic theologian and critic of our culture, and T.S. Eliot is a poet. And Tillich said, "After all, we need you poets especially, because when we read you, we suddenly recognize that you have the questions." And Eliot responded and said, "Well, yes, this is the relationship which we feel is most vital, because we as artists have the questions, even with our media, but what we do not have often would be the answers." And what we need are the answers to the questions we see at our given time. Now, you'll notice that whole approach to the arts depends pretty heavily on the idea that the intelligent citizenry, the informed Christian, deepens his understanding of his faith the more that he expands and enlarges his vision and his understanding of the arts. But I think you should know, and that's why it's fun to work with it, and most of you have operated with it in your own lives, that there's another kind of approach which is radically opposed to the idea of the arts as essentially propraedeutic, and it's or as a propaganda for the faith, or as the way in which we anticipate the arts which can be laid on the human sensorium. And I'm thinking of the work of a former distinguished pastor who became probably one of our greatest living critics. His name is Northrop Frye. Northrop Frye is essentially an ordained Church of Christ pastor in Canada, who I was surprised to see, for example, when the Lutheran Commission on Worship was working on its Lutheran Book of Worship. We used samples from all the various hymnals that had been developed by the churches, and the United Church of Christ in Canada had recently developed a hymn book, and there in the front of the book is one of the contributors, is the name of Northrop Frye, who offered his particular expertise in poetry and as a former pastor to the Canadian church. Well, he wrote a very distinguished book some years back that was put out by Princeton called Anatomy of Criticism. And in it, he thought there was something else that could be said about the relationship between the church and the arts, or between the church and culture. And he put it, I could read the quote, but let me summarize it, because it seemed too professorial if I read the quote. He put it somewhere this way. He said, "The whole history of Western civilization is a history of various idolatries competing for one another. And for the church really to be what it is as a church, true and integral and honest to itself, it has to allow for culture, the world of the arts, of literature, drama, music, it has to allow it to be completely free and autonomous." Notice what he's saying. He's saying we cannot as Christians assume that we have all the answers to begin with, and that we can merely assume that the arts deepen our appreciation or enlarge our understanding of the faith. He's saying that in the history of Western culture, the history is of a series of changes, always, in how we perceive and hold the truth. And for that reason, there needs to be a healthy tension, a conflict, if you will, between the church and the arts, in which the church also listens to the arts and listens to it as that arena in modern culture where, if not final answers, there is a probing of the kind of idolatries that are present everywhere, even and sometimes especially in the church. For he, this is what he thinks. He thinks that what we do in the church itself is that we begin to substitute for the experience of the presence of God in human experience our particular understandings and notions, our little systems and ideas of what is the experience of God in human life. And because we do, we have to allow for the possibility that God's Spirit is much at work outside of the institutional church, for example, as he may be in the living creative activity of the artist inside of the church. Those are two reasons for, I think, returning to the topic, because we had explored pretty well the topic of the arts is very vital. Now, here's the big question. You know, one young lady raised the question back there. Are the arts merely ornamental to the ongoing life of the Christian community? Are they something we pull in accidentally? Or are they essential to the life of the Christian community? If they are, and this is, of course, her presupposition, I take it, as she made her observation as a young teacher, usually in her experience, meeting what we call the American Philistines, you know, the great unwashed multitudes that come into the university. And she was responding to what she saw as a kind of bias. And up in the balcony, there was another man who responded as a prophet's voice, I think, to us all. And he just simply said apodictically, that is, with final absolute assertion, art is dead. Art is dead. And it was an honest expression of a position which we, I think, would have liked to have heard unfolded. And I return to that because it seems to me that in a healthy community, with the arts vividly understood and the symbols around which we cluster worked out, we, I think, understand how conflict, creative conflict, is probably one of the most vital issues at stake in the Christian community, and probably mediated helpfully by the arts. Now, how they can be, it'd be another question. I thought, later on, if we have time, I'd love to talk about Holden Village and brief observations I've been able to make about it and enjoy it immensely, and particularly talk about its dish crews as a way of understanding the function of a community of this type. But maybe we won't have time to do that. All right. Now, so I suggested in summary that we take another approach, and we do have some, I know, sitting around this circle and in the audience, we have people who are sensitive and who are attuned, who have had a large or narrow experience in the relationship between the church and the arts, and I've used the word arts in the broadest sense here, and who have had, who may have strong feelings one way or the other about the role of the arts in the life of the Christian community. Those of you who have worked in the visual arts know or are probably familiar with the kinds of studies that have been done indicate that you know, in the post-Reformation time, it was pretty sad that much of the visual arts, if I remember correctly from the studies I've read, and you can help correct me on this, is that some of the greatest art that was done, for example, Rembrandt's illustrations of the Bible, were not done under commission of the church. Their essential use was in the private devotional life of a particular artist whom we now look upon as a great contributing genius in that tradition, but his relationship to the institutional church was minimal. Not only is this true of the artist, now there are always exceptions in music, because I suppose music is nonverbal, it is less threatening to the Christian community, just as architecture may not be either. But when you get into story and work, here, you know, the problems of relationships between the church and the arts become much more poignant, and they generate a great deal of conflict, and certainly they become sources of offense, even down to the finest and littlest kinds of styles a preacher may use in a sermon on a summer Sunday morning. And if that style is what we would call low rhetoric, or if it's vulgar, it certainly can alienate an entire audience that may be accustomed to the use of plain language for the edification of the people, and certainly appreciate that a lot more than the florid and elaborate rhetorical style we remember of our fathers' or grandfathers' generation, because it rings more true. But my guess would be it's precisely at those points that we have our strongest feelings and emotional reactions within the church. Or, you know, you talk to some practicing artists, and I always think of Jacques Maritain, who wrote a book by the Scholastics called Scholasticism in Art. Here's a Roman Catholic thinker who's been very interested in the whole creative process. And when he wrote back in the 40s, he said, take a look at the kind of commercial religious art that is belched out of the furnaces of commercial religious houses. He said it's an offense to the integrity and honesty of the Christian faith, but it should be characterized by such falseness in its piety. Or you are maybe familiar with Paul Tillich's. Now, I'm speaking as someone who, when I was a teenager, had in my study Solomon's Head of Christ as my favorite understanding of the piety of the Christian faith, and was shocked to discover as I grew up that my piety, which was honest and sincere, was probably characterized, and this is what Tillich has said in his, I think he's on target. He says, I find more of the Spirit of God in its power and triumph at work in Van Gogh's Starry Night, with all of its swirling stars, than I find in the, and here's, I quote pretty carefully from him, the self-sufficient finite capitalism I see present in the face of Christ in the Solomon portrayal of Christ. Now that's a strong statement. And I say this out of the same kind of background that we all come out of. And I remember the shock and how offended I was. It was about 18 or 19 at the time, to see that this Solomon Head of Christ, which I felt was the key point of Christian art, was a representative of the most vicious kind of understanding of whom Christ was. Well, those of you who've had these kinds of experiences, or your own growth and development, or your own sense of offense, know how delicate this kind of question can be in the Christian community. What does the pastor do when his lady's aide volunteers to stitch vestments for the altar, or even for him? And it's quite obvious that his lady's aid and its intention and its piety is so consecrated and good and hardworking that there is no one who wouldn't say that's one of the finest gifts they could possibly make. But who hasn't also been in a situation where you would have to say the particular taste of the Ladies Guild and its knowledge of Christian symbolism is probably so weak that the pastor is going to have some problem, maybe, with his own particular relationship to his people and knowing just exactly how he's going to wear it, or when he's going to wear it, or how long the ladies' people will live. It becomes a real serious problem. And in I remember in some churches they have to establish little councils. Shall we or shall we not accept gifts from the people for Christmas, the creches, and all? And of course, it's probably one of the finest ways to offend some of the best people in your congregation, by raising any kinds of issues about the nature of the work of art, whether it's music or the visual arts or church building. You know, all of us know, as you've heard it over and over again from other presenters here, how often we lean in our practical sense to letting the contractor do it and not worrying about the vision of the architect, particularly if it gets a little bit more expensive. And we are really sensitive to the need for being a pilgrim church, and we don't want monumental structures that characterize the church. All of this can generate the kind of basic conflicts we have known. What I'm trying to urge is, I think, that the conflict, at least the confrontation of the conflict, can be good if we understand something about the nature of the church as a human community centered around central symbols, which can generate healthy, open discussion, debate, and hopefully resolution. Am I touching you at any sensitive points? No. Two sensitive points. I'm not sure about the style of the life of the church. I'm in a university community, and there it seems terribly authoritarian, elitist, very good, very distinct. You know, how much it represents the actual life of the community is another kind of question. And I'm sure I always found that one of the greatest definitions of style I've ever run across in English style is from an old folklore scholar at the University of Wisconsin, Hans Jobs. He said, we're always asked, what's good style? And he says, whatever puts your audience at ease, it's what makes them comfortable, is good style. So it may mean in worship that it has to be thought through much more carefully within each local community, so that the worship that is the part of the life of the community is something that is something which we feel comfortable. See, I've come back from the other point. I suggest that the conflict between the community as a source of vigorous and vital art, which is not tapped often within our congregations, and the problem of authority and specialization and knowledge and the conflict between the two can be one which generates a really lively Christian kind of community in its worship and in its I think the entire life of its congregation. All right. Let me carry this one step further. There are experiments being carried on, some successful and some unsuccessful, on a question that I would ask of anyone in this kind of community. How essential are the arts in the life of any social community? We'll say they are absolutely essential, because the artist is the one who teaches us probably how to see and what to see, to hear and what to hear in the first place. They may even say that things get so bad in the church that we no longer can see adequately. Hear accurately. There are men, let me mention the one man who's fascinated me. He's a radical Roman Catholic convert from Anglicanism in England to what he felt was a real problem in our time. He was reacting to kinds of criticism that men like C. Wright Mills had made about American churches and American culture. They say, when you look at the church, it is essentially a passive instrument in society. It is known primarily for not shaping, acting, serving as salt, wherever it is in time and space, but essentially for being passive, reacting, responding. And because it has lost its essential creating and shaping activity in the human community. He thought this was deeply rooted in the problems, as we did touch on a little bit on them, in our educational system. An educational system which rests, let me quote from him because he's so fascinating on this particular problem. He says, in a rather strange book called Culture and Liturgy, which he is actually a radical socialist in the English setting, not in our American setting, he argues very carefully that somehow, if we're really going to have vital churches and vital worship in the community, we have to have a tremendous different understanding of what it means to be a congregation in a church. And he put it this way. Seems to me that every person's experience is mediated by his own characteristic personality, which is the product of his past experience and of the cultural tradition which lies behind and around him on every side. Now, we all know this in plain language. We are pretty much the shape and the tastes and the values of our family, our parents, and our education.
Fritz Axel said of Luther, the man I mentioned yesterday,
yes.
The South of Christ had to travel through a German route, alas.
All right. Yes, you can see signs of this immensely. I remember reading Concordia Seminary when I was there. I had to go back into the archives to see how it was the relationship of our German forebears to the world of culture in America. I could find no relationship between any statement. There was one statement that was made when the seminary was built in St. Louis, and it was dedicated, peculiarly enough, with this title. In the German, the Seminary and College of St. Louis. The vision of the shapers of the seminary in America originally had hoped, Missouri Synod background people, that their seminary would be attached to a college, to a liberal arts college. But of course they were so poor that they could never afford the college. All they could afford eventually was the seminary. And when that stone was laid, our great forebear in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod tradition, C.F.W. Walther, made a statement about the relationship between the church and culture. And he said, it's rather interesting, he said, we don't want our pastors, we want the learned ministry that we've had from Europe here. And so he said, the world of Kunst und Wissenschaft shall be part, that is the arts and the sciences, the social sciences particularly, shall be part of every pastor's experience. And then he went on to name whom he would expect them to know. And of course he names Goethe and he mentions the whole German tradition. I could not find a single reference to anything English or American until Theodore Grebner wrote a little book back in the second decade of this century called The Pastor is Student and Literary Worker. And there he says, it'd be a good idea if our pastors, now this is only a relatively short time ago within our own history in America, he said it would be good if our pastors did know some Shakespeare and possibly some of the other writers. But, you know, that's the first time in the history of these churches that there was any real attempt to recognize. Now, I'm not talking about the personal style of the pastors. I think most of us know that There was a rich personal life in the Pfarrhaus of the 19th century and the 20th century, and certainly in singing and music. It was an enviable pattern for anybody to follow. But the fact is that, as Wicker tries to indicate, our shapes are pretty well deeply formed in these early years, and they become key. Notice what he goes on to say. He wants to distinguish between what we call culture, which, you know, most of us feel along with, I think, Sir Herbert Reed, or I'll build up to this. Remember George Bernard Shaw saying that an Englishman thinks he's cultured when he's bored at a symphony. Or he gives all the, you know, these are the seven deadly virtues. One of them is to be a cultured Englishman. Or Ezra Pound would write, you know, culture, and spell out with a K, culture, and all that. Or Sir Herbert Reed writes a book, and he titles it, To Hell with Culture. The fact is that when we think of culture in that way, it is one of the most disturbing things that you can have. Forrester wrote that famous little short story called The Celestial Omnibus, in which there is a so-called learned man in there who has his Dante all bound and vellum, and his name is Mr. Bonds, which is snob, spelled backwards. And Forrester uses the short story to make the kinds of announcements on the false culture that I think many times we associate with the arts and music in the church. We're not talking, I hope at least that we're clear on that, we're not talking about that kind of terribly embarrassing, artificial, and false understanding of the arts in the church. There's nothing more disturbing, I suppose, than culture vultures. If it's a distorted and false understanding of the way in which the arts do reflect deep immersion in our common Christian life. But Wicker wants to go on. He wants to talk about what he's talking about in terms of culture is the way the church is a vehicle for social change in the human community, and the way in which the central symbols of the church, its liturgy, its worship, its music, its art, its past and its future are all fused into the life of the worshiping community, so that it is a nerve center shaping the taste of the young, but shaping it in such a way that when the young go out, their Christian faith and its relationship to the culture makes them agents and sources of genuine social change in the community. And for a man like Wicker, this cannot be done unless the congregation and the Christian community in its time and space can be a lively, worshiping, vital, alive community, alive to the central symbols of its tradition. Now, when I read Mr. Wicker's book, I was so fascinated by it, I thought, well, isn't this interesting? Here's a man, and here was his point. Oh, he thinks probably that, well, let me use an illustration, that our entire educational system is probably one of the things that ought to be done away with, because it's based so much on the idea of the teacher as an authority figure who has all these little bottles out there, open-necked and empty, and what he does is somehow or other take the sponge and squeeze it, and if he's lucky, or flick it out there, and brilliant quotations from his lecture, and the people or the bottles happen to catch this, and it's caught up. Well, as you and I know, that's the painful way in which some information can be communicated, but it has little to do with education. And for Brian Wicker and for others, the real key element is to be able to enter into such a relationship with the student that we have what possibility for the instructor? That he will change along with the student as both are involved in the pursuit of knowledge and in the refinement of their interpretation and their judgment. That means, for Wicker, that if the church is a lively community and if schools are genuinely what Paul Tillich thought they should be, let me quote from him. He says, what should the church school be? And he's talking about, I take it, the what we would consider to be our adult education programs in our churches. He says, the church school, on its way of giving its people and its children, as well as its adults, into the symbols and realities of the Christian life, must remain aware of the fact that Christianity has accepted the humanistic principle by identifying Jesus as the Christ with the universal logos. That's how the Gospel of John opens up. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And because it was the unifying principle, he says, that means that the church is at the heart of the creative structure of everything that is, as its Lord is at the heart of the structure of everything that is. Christianity includes humanism and a radical question of truth, which is that first principle. Therefore, what do we do in our churches and our schools, according to Tillich? We must include the possibility of relating question and answer, and especially the radicalism of a question, so that there may be an opening up of the young human being, as well as the old, to all human possibilities, and providing opportunities where we may develop that freedom which we have been given in the gospel of Christ as risen Lord. Wicker picks up on this and sees, therefore, the church as the instrument of this kind of possible shaping of the culture. To do it only if we understand that that process is a long, painful, frequently but joyful apprenticeship relationship. More recently, other critics, particularly those who've been attuned to the political sciences, have seen the arts as the essential elements of social change in the culture. And without going into elaborate detail on that, I could elaborate on that more, but I'm thinking of men like Kenneth Burke, who look at the Christian faith as the model for the way in which communities operate, but who is not a Christian, and who are fascinated by the ways in which communities are put together. For example, I mean, he thinks that just about every organization that we would look at, and I assume this is true of Holden Village as well as many organizations or congregations or places where we work, and the way they operate, he says they are based essentially on a pretty tight hierarchy. And that hierarchy and structure depends upon leaders and followers. And that has to be, it's pretty carefully structured as a ladder of relationships and responsibility wherever you go. So at Holden Village, we have camp director and program director. We must necessarily have that kind of leadership. But then he says, what keeps any kind of community going? He says, it's essentially a very complicated and interesting community which is held together primarily by language and by communication and by an elaborate system of courtship in which everyone on the ladder from one direction to the other, up and down, is courting one another. The leaders are courting the followers, and the followers are courting the leaders. We all know when to use the appropriate language to anyone who's up the ladder from us. We all know how you've got to use very careful, particular communication when you've got anyone down the ladder from you. Why, says Burke? Because whether we are leaders or followers, what's going to happen in any community? You're going to generate guilt. Those people up on the top, how are they going to feel when they give orders to people they don't know if they have any humanity or just as human as they are? They're going to feel kind of bad if they have to say to somebody, you know, get on the dish crew and do those particular dishes. They're going to feel some guilt. And those who are on the dish crew are going to feel some resentment along the ladder. Because if you look at, say, a community of this type, you've got your leaders, and then you've got your staff, and then you've got your faculty, and you had your guests, you had your campers. I notice you have all kinds of terms that come in here to arrange the different ways in which the groups come together. He says in that elaborate kind of relationship, it becomes very key that this community of communication, this network of communication, be carried on in such a way that the guilt can be taken care of so that the community can survive and really be a lively, comic relationship. Now for Burke, what happens, of course, too often is that we get victims, or we find victims, and we persecute them. And finally, we will crucify them if we have to, whether they're innocent or guilty. We need both types, innocent victims and guilty victims. But ordinarily, for Burke, the one way in which this can be escaped to lead to what we would call unhappy victimage is through open sources of communication among the various levels so that we can unload the guilt which is generated by the rhetoric of deception we sometimes have to use in the latter, by the resentments that build up as we sense there are injustices wherever we go. And, of course, for Burke, the central way of handling this system of network of relationships is to have solid and stable symbols which make it possible for us to accept one another in our humanity as people who know what it is like to need a large, carefully complex, worked out social system. I'll sort of run through this rapidly to indicate how these men now feel. Now, what do? They think that the best way to prepare people for the fact that you can grow and develop and change in any community is to be familiar with the vision of the artist, who, whether he works in his media, whether he works in his performance, wherever he may be, is always operating with a model of change and alteration and of possibility. And because he is, and because if this is done well in the community, we are always giving to our people a vision of what can happen in the human community, so long as we can handle the terrible problem of our own inadequacies and our temptation to dominate other human beings. I haven't gone into the Dishku carefully or elaborately. According to Burke, you also have to have certain, in other words, for us, we do it for us, you have to have certain values which become the central core of a community. And they will be the things for which you are willing to die or for which you are willing to suffer. It seems to me that one of the most beautiful things at Holden Village is the Dish Crew. Because what it does is it equalizes everyone on the ladder. And it makes it possible in this community. And that's what's so beautiful about that kind of physical work. What it does is it takes the community and says, here are those works which are voluntary, or either always include human free of sin. And they are the vital kinds of works in which all of us come together for the fundamental value of the community and are willing to sacrifice for it. And there is, of course, this is true of the whole life of Holden Village. It probably is a kind of model of it. But it complements, of course, the way in which the worship services celebrate the values for which we are willing to be mortified in our daily life. And if this is true, it suggests a rhythm and a tension that can be creative of a genuine, working community which will have its conflicts, which will generate its guilt, which will have its resentments, but which, if it's functioning rightly, will also have a way of not smoothing them over. You've always got that duty and that responsibility to face from the point of view of the equity and justice of the community to keep it surviving. And in that kind of rhythm, there is, as there is can be in any kind of community, a beautiful, enhancing comedy of relationships for Burke, who I think is terribly alert to the fact that if we don't work out these kinds of ways of talking out our conflicts, what we do is we find victims and we crucify and kill and hurt and doom them. That's how we are as human beings. His is a secular response to what he sees as the unhappy victimage that takes place in too many cultures because we do not have those lines of communication which open us up to the facing of conflict. Thus, for these men, the arts are absolutely essential as direct and indirect ways of preparing a community for change. Now, as I recognize we're at the end of the session, or we haven't generated a discussion yet, hope to, and I what I was curious about would be, say, a question of this type. It's raised often. Do you think, or let me put it positively, and we could ask someone like Anne or the visual artists to respond to this because it's a more complicated kind of question. What is Christian art? That would be the positive way of stating it. And the negative way of stating it would be this. Does a picture or a painter or an artist who does not embody in the painting or the artist some actual representative symbol of the Christian faith, is that a Christian art or is it not? What do you think? Okay, Jim White from the Minneapolis.
I'll say once more into my anecdote.
Okay.
When G.K. Chesterton visited Times Square right after neon had been perfected with all those flashing lights advertising everything, he looked it over and said to a friend, "How beautiful if I didn't know how to read." And I would say a church would be just the opposite. Things are beautiful to the extent that everything in the church can be read in the light of the Gospels and Paul's letters. And if somehow art somehow takes over and the artist has such autonomy that he can no longer be read, there's something wrong there. The Playboy had this cartoon that's a variation on that. The churches of Europe mostly become works of art. They are large museums. They're where the guide says to the little woman in black who's kneeling, "Move on, you're disturbing the tourist." So, to turn Chesterton wrong side out, it's beautiful if it can be read. Because the center of the gospel to me, a Protestant, is what can be read.
Now, outside of the Baptist church in New Orleans, I remember there were three signs, and they flicked on and off this way.
Ouch.
The Bible says it, we believe it, that settles it. The Bible says it, we believe it. Anyone have, you're very, it sounds not just Baptist, but very good Lutheran. The text is the key thing, and music, everything needs to further that end. And if the music does not enhance, enlarge, and sharpen the text, I guess most Lutheran musicians with that choice, I don't know if they're honest or not, say that they would choose that kind of music. Is that right, Paul?
I think so. It either has to be relevant or it has to make the grade. And I think this is one of the positive things about the LD, one of the many positive things about the LDW. It is de-emphasized the anthem per se, which has been a kind of a showpiece, sometimes totally unrelated, and has tried to draw in and coalesce the liturgical parts of the service, which leave great.
Now, suppose we have a lot of lay people here. Do you understand what Paul Mantz is saying about what's happened with the new Lutheran Book of Worship? You want to expand on that a little bit?
Well, I don't know just where to take off on that, but the Lutheran Book of Worship has tried to present a liturgical menu, so to speak, for each of its services, where everything fits together not in smorgasbord fashion, but fits together intricately, both this way and that way, up and sideways. And in doing that, it has, I think, in a way, not really de-emphasized the sermon, but it has put the sermon in its proper perspective as an exposition of what is going on in the service. And everything else has to relate to it. And if it doesn't relate, then out with it. And I don't expect that the immediate result will be known immediately, but I think over a long haul it will come. We're bound to shake, we have a shakedown period. I think it will come. It's certainly improvement in the right direction. I move in the right direction, I'm sorry.
The suggestion being, of course, that our children's worship will probably be a much more vital kind of worship.
Yes, I had dinner this evening with a pastor who was commenting about the beautiful bread we were eating, and he said, well, you know what the texts were all about yesterday? And I said, yes, three lessons were all about the food. And he said, well, you know what I did for my children's sermon? I said, no, what? He said, I went out on Friday and I bought some frozen bread. And early on Sunday morning, yesterday morning, I put it in the oven to the church and baked it. And when the people came to church, they could smell this marvelous bread. And then he had a children's sermon. He brought all the children up in the front and told them the story and passed out pieces of bread. Made a profound impression upon them.
How marvelous when you think of what happened just 10 years ago with when Paul Goodman, a radical critic, was on a panel discussion, and what's her name? Our singer of folk songs, Joan Baez, was on the panel. One of the students came up and said, hey, what about contemporary American culture? And he said, look, here's a loaf of Wonder Bread. And he crushed it into a little ball and said, here's to American culture. And Paul Goodman said, well, he said, all right, the bread may be bad, but that doesn't mean you have to burn the factory. It's the making of the bread and the using of it. It's vital.